This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. The name Alan Lomax may or may not be familiar, but if not for his pioneering work seeking out and recording folk singers and other isolated rural artists, other names would be less familiar as well. The names of Woody Guthrie, Muddy Waters, Lead Belly, and other artists whom Lomax was the first to record. Alan Lomax died in 2002 at age 87. A new biography has just been written by John Zwed, a professor of music and jazz studies at Columbia University, called Alan Lomax, The Man Who Recorded the World. To note the book's publication and to salute one of the most important folklorists of the 20th century, today we're going to do a little audio archiving of our own and listen to an interview Terry Gross recorded with Lomax in 1990. Alan and his father, John Lomax, traveled the South together making recordings, which introduced Americans to musicians in every type of folk music, made on porches, living rooms, plantations, prisons, and chain gangs. Their 1959 recording of a chain gang at Mississippi State Penitentiary is featured on the O Brother, Where Art Thou soundtrack. When Alan Lomax and his father recorded musicians, they used one of the first portable recording machines.
The first machine that my father and I took out was a Thomas Edison cylinder machine. And then the Library of Congress kindly replaced that with a disc machine that embossed the groove on an aluminum disc. But for a long time, I was a media bug because I saw that the job of the folklorist was to make a bridge between people who had no voice and the big world of communication. And that's what I did for the first, half of my life, was simply run with a recording machine and record. In here, in the West Indies, in Italy, in Spain, in Great Britain, and to encourage other people to do it and to publish the results, because this was the way that people could learn that other folks were out there just as interesting as they were. That's the first big lesson of the recording machine.
When you first started recording, you were a teenager and you were on the road with your father. What were your responsibilities in those very early days?
Well, basically, I ran the machine and lifted it and carried it. The whole thing weighed about 500 pounds, and I broke it down and put it in the back of our Ford, Model A Ford, often two or three times a day. It kept the fat off of me.
Your father had been fired from his position at the University of Texas for recording cowboy songs, which were considered very dirty at the time. What was the reputation of folk music then? Did people not really understand what it was about? I mean, so much so that your father would be fired for for taking it down?
The Puritan West Europeans really haven't ever had very much use for art or for recreation or for fun. So the arts have always been something extra. And they had to mind their place. They had to conform to the rules of society. So the big threat, of course, was that the subject of sex would be mentioned. Remember, America in the 19th century was the most hung-up part of the whole world, or maybe ever had been, on the question of sex. Women were just untouchable. So anyway, my father was kicked out of the university for collecting cowboy songs on the grounds that some of them were dirty. They weren't, not in his book. And then later on at the Library of Congress, when I was running the folk song archive there, the archive was shut down by a rabid born-again Southern who attacked it because we had recorded that rantankerous, rambling ballad maker, Woody Guthrie. He just then, by the way, composed This Land Is Your Land, and I just recorded it for the Library of Congress. But they were so severe about it that they cut the whole Library of Congress appropriation out. Later it was put back, but the archive didn't recover for many years. And I think that's just the kind of thing that's happened recently.
Folklorist Alan Lomax is my guest. Let me get back to the days when you were on the road traveling through the South recording songs. You and your father were, I think, the first people to actually record in prison camps in the South. Why did you want to go there to record songs?
Well, there's always been an anomaly in the black community. All secular songs, and this follows out my Calvinist hypothesis, were considered sinful. Anything that wasn't religious was sinful. So that the whole of the secular, great secular song art of the black, the blues, the hollers, the work songs, all the casual songs of amusement were forbidden. You could be church. You could be kicked out of the church for singing them if you were a black person in a respectable black community. So that it was very difficult for us to get at this rich and unknown treasure trove of American music and lyricism without in the normal black community. People were scared to sing them, scared of criticism. So we decided to go where the devils were. I mean, the people who were beyond redemption. And we found them in the prisons, and we recorded a whole literature, which is still virtually unknown. Enormous song bag of beautiful tunes, new kinds of melodies, and all sorts of things we found in the prison camps of the South.
I think the best known of the recordings that you made of prisoners was your recordings with Leadbelly, and you continued to record him after he got out.
Yeah, we did the first singer biography of him.
Let me play one of the recordings you made by Leadbelly, and this is Midnight Special. Would you like to say a few words about the circumstances under which you recorded it or the song itself?
Well, Leadbelly had been in the Texas pen a couple of times, but we found him in the Louisiana penitentiary where prisoners were not allowed to sing in the fields, but they could have their own entertainers, and Leadbelly was a camp entertainer. He had his guitar there. And we went to camp number one, and when he heard we were there, he ran 100 yards from his cell to where we were, arrived without even breathing hard, and sat down and sang Irene Goodnight was the first song he sang us, and he sang a song to appeal to the governor of Louisiana to let him out of there, because woman was mourning for him. And then he sang, among other things, the great Midnight Special, which is actually the song of the main theme song of the Texas Penitentiary, Let the Midnight Special Shine Its Ever-Loving Light on You. Think of prisoners who don't know whether they'll live through the next day, who are working from dawn in the morning till dark at night, who, if they fall afoul of a guard, may be beaten to death, hanging on the bars, absolutely stone-weary, and watching the headlight of some onrushing train flash across the walls of their prison and into their faces. That's the mood of the song.
About a bar and the dress she wore, umbrella on the shoulder, see the paper in her hand. Well, I'm going in at the governor, he's trying to lose a mom, man. Let the midnight special shine your light on me. Let the midnight special shine a heaven loving light on me. When I get up in the morning, when that big bell rings, over marching to the table. Need the same old thing, not the smoke on the table, and nothing in my pants. Never said a thing about it, having trouble with the man. Let the midnight special shine your light on me. Let the midnight special shine your ever-loving light on me.
That's Leadbelly, and that was recorded by you and your father?
Well, I don't know. I've recorded it so many times with him, I don't know.
I see, okay,
which
right.
Recording was which.
When Leadbelly was released from prison, he traveled with your father for a couple of years, and your father put on a lot of concerts for him. Do you have any memories of what it was like for Leadbelly going from the South to the North and suddenly, like, performing for folklorist for intellectuals performing at Harvard University. Was there a period of culture shock and serious adaptation for him?
Not at all. He was just in triumph. In his mind, and it was true, he was the best in the world. He was the king of the 12-string guitar players in the world. He had a voice you could hear for a mile, an absolutely beautiful silvery tenor voice. It's never been heard, by the way. It's only on our first recordings. It began to go as he lived in the city.
When you were recording musicians, did you ever take co-composer credit for one of their songs? I know that was often the case with people.
No. That came very much later. What happened was that we gave out our songs from the Library of Congress in our books for everybody to use. And then along came a lot of new people in the field who simply copyrighted them completely. Lonnie Donegan in England copyrighted all of Lead Belly's songs. And in order to protect the material, the only way that the publishing industry saw that I could do it was for me to co-claim them with some of the singers. And I did that. And that made it possible for the singers and their families to get royalties and for money to be to come into my hands so I could continue to do research.
I want to ask you about, I think, what's considered to be among the most important recordings you've ever made, and I'm thinking of the recordings you made with Jelly Roll Morton, the Library of Congress recordings, which features both him singing and playing, as well as talking about his life. How did you get to make those recordings with him?
Well, as I used a recording machine in the field, I began to discover that what an artist would say about the song at the end of a performance was usually psychologically and emotionally very revealing. And I began to record more and more of these codas to songs. And gradually, the codas began to stretch out longer and longer until I was recording whole life histories. And I had done a number of these by the time Jelly Roll came to the Library of Congress, anxious to prove to the world that jazz was not from Memphis, as Handy had said it was in a Billboard interview, but was from New Orleans. And Jelly Roll, an extraordinary intellectual he was, had the whole story worked out when he came to me in my office, which was backstage of the Coolidge Auditorium, the Library of Congress. On the stage was a grand piano. Around the hall there were the busts of Bach and Beethoven. Jelly Roll sat down at the piano, completely at home with his peers, because he was, after all, our first literate native composer, and began to tell the story of jazz. Naturally, I was no great friend of jazz at the time, because jazz was what was driving folk music into obscurity, in my view. But this man was so fascinating that I thought I would try to find out how much, well, folklore there was in him. And within an hour, he'd said such wonderful things that I raced upstairs, got permission to work with him for a week and to use any number of discs to take down his life. That's how it all happened.
Let me play a short excerpt of the oral history that you recorded. Jelly Roll Morton is talking about when he started to play in the Tenderloin District in New Orleans.
In my younger days, I was brought in to the Tenderloin District by friends, young friends, of course. Even before we were in long pants, we used to steal long pants from around the fathers and brothers and uncles and so forth and so on.
Could you go down there before we had long pants on?
Why, the policeman would run you right in jail. It'd run you ragged. Of course, we kids from time to time would climb those 8 and 10 feet high board fences. We'd really climb them and get away from these people, but they kept us right out of the district. They'd take the straps on the end of the clubs and just make switches out of them, cut our legs into ribbons, and was very frightened of, very much frightened. I happened to invade that section, one of the sections of the district where the birth of jazz originated.
Where was that? How old were you?
At that time, that was the year of 1902. I was about 17 years old. I happened to go to Villeray and Bienville. At that time, one of the most famous night spots after everything was closed. There was only a back room where all the greatest pianists frequented after they got off from work. All the pianists got off from work in the sporting houses at around 4 or after, unless they had plenty of money involved. And they would go to this Frenchman's. That was the name of the place, Saloon. And there would be everything in the line of hilarity there. They would have even millionaires to come to listen to the different great pianists, what would no doubt be their favorites maybe among them.
Jillero Morton, recorded by my guest Alan Lomax back in 1938. How did you meet Woody Guthrie? I want to play one of the records that that you made with him. How did you first meet him?
Well, at the time I was doing a series of radio programs for CBS called Back Where I Come From in the evening, and then we had a morning series about the wellsprings of music. It was the first time that folk music was on a coast-to-coast radio network in the country, and I was looking for people for that show. I was the master of ceremonies at a benefit congress, at a benefit evening for Loyalist Spain, and Woody was on the program. And he just got in from California, and this little dusty-headed man stood up there. He told stories more than he talked at that time. He could hold an audience just like Will Rogers, and sang "So Long It's Been Good to Know You" and his other songs. And he went home with me that weekend to Washington. He spent a week at my house, and we cooked up the program that I put on CBS with him at the time.
Well, let's hear some of "So Long It's Been Good to Know You," and we'll hear the end of "So Long It's Been Good to Know You," and then a little bit of Woody Guthrie talking about why he wrote the song.
The church houses were jammed and packed. People was sitting from front to the back. It was so dusty. The preacher couldn't read his text, so he folded his specs and he took up collection. Said, "So long, it's been good to know you. So long, been good to know you. So long, it's been good to know you. This dusty old dust isn't rolling me home. Gotta be drifting along."
Well, what did you people do then? What happened to your folks, your relatives and neighbors and acquaintances and people like you all through that country from Panhandle to Nebraska?
Well, Alan, they didn't know what to do. They sat around and talked there for weeks and weeks. Hated to give up what they'd worked there for 50 years and been born and raised on and had their kids on, and their kids had been born and raised and married on and had their kids on this land. They didn't know just exactly what to do, but they couldn't pay their debts. They owed the bankers $3,500, $4,000 on a combined harvester, $1,100 on a tractor. They owed them a year's fuel bill, which always amounted to several hundred dollars. They owed a grocery bill for about a year. They owed all kinds of bills, seed bills and everything else. When they couldn't pay them, well, naturally, they come down with a mortgage and took their land. These people didn't have but one thing to do, and that was just to get out in the middle of the road. Incidentally, the 66 Highway runs just about a mile.
Woody Guthrie is featured on the Library of Congress recordings made by my guest folklorist Alan Lomax. How do you think your role as folklorist has changed over the years? Or perhaps I should ask, how do you think the role of the folklorist has changed?
Well, so far as I'm concerned, I'm still doing the thing that I was inspired to do in our early recording sessions, when people would look at the microphone and say, "Mr. President, I want you to come down here and help us people where we are in our hard times in this place." They looked at my father and myself as a channel to tell their troubles and to let their lives be known. That's what I've essentially tried to do all my life.
Alan Lomax speaking with Terry Gross in 1990. John Zwed's new biography, Alan Lomax, The Man Who Recorded the World, has just been published. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fred McDowell, recorded by Alan Lomax. Our next guests are Will Ferrell, star of the cop comedy The Other Guys, and Adam McKay, who directed and co-wrote the film. It's just come out on DVD. The movie is the latest in a long string of collaborations between the two, who first teamed up when Ferrell was a cast member of Saturday Night Live and McKay was a writer. The Other Guys is a satire of buddy cop movies and action films about the cops who are not the action heroes of the police force. Will Ferrell and Mark Wahlberg play cops assigned to desk duty. Ferrell's character is happy where he is, Wahlberg's character is not. Early in the film, two daring members of the police force, played by Samuel Jackson and Dwayne Johnson, The Rock, return triumphantly to police headquarters after catching some bad guys. They're welcomed with a round of applause.
We know. All right, listen up. We're having a celebration tonight at Butter. Brody Jenner's going to be there, and most of you are on the list.
You're the best.
Guys, I'm going to say something right now. We couldn't do our job if it weren't for you guys doing all the paperwork, answering the phone.
All the gunfights, all the car chases, all the sex we don't want to have with women, but we have to all do to what you guys do. Thank you.
And we do it again and again.
Hey, you shut your face! If we want to hear you talk, I will work your mouth like a puppet. You hear me? Caspar.
Yes. Yeah.
Terry Gross spoke with Will Ferrell and Adam McKay last year and started by discussing another scene from the film.
No, I love the opening scene. It's a great satire of the obligatory opening car chase scene in cop movies. You know, there's the bullet flying in slow motion before it hits its target. The car's crashing, cars flying through the air, cars crashing through glass windows. One of the cops jumps onto the hood of a moving car. Innocent bystanders are watching in horror. And it's also quickly edited that you can't follow what's going on or who's doing what to who. So what are some of the elements you really wanted to parody in the opening?
Well, that was the idea, was the gross excess of the whole sort of modern day heroes as they're kind of perceived through movies and TV, just how sort of ridiculously over the top they are. And, you know, the real truth is cops had to stop doing high speed chases because they were doing too much property damage. So there's an agreement with most police that they go, OK, let's back off and eventually we'll catch the guy. And so at the end of our giant chase, of course, you find out that it was all over a quarter pound of marijuana, that they destroyed 40 vehicles and blew up a building.
Yeah, we actually went on a couple ride-alongs with NYPD detectives, and I kept asking the guy I was with, like, you have any crazy chase stories? And they basically said, no, we kind of lay back and know that they'll probably come back again. So don't try to be a hero. If you want to be a hero, join the fire department. So it's funny to kind of make fun of the, like Adam said, the gross excess.
One of the other things you make fun of, too, is how in cop movies the cops are always making – well, not always, but in a certain kind of cop movie, the cops are always making witty retorts just as their lives are most at risk. So can you talk about trying to write the best retorts?
We actually wrote some that it might have been a little too inside for the audience, but at one point – Samuel Jackson and Dwayne Johnson crash through a bus in their car, and there's just sort of a beat where they're in the bus. And obviously he's supposed to say a funny line. At one point we had him say a line like, man, I feel a lot of pressure to say something clever right now. And that really made us laugh. But I think it was like, it's funny, you make fun of it, but you also want it to be a little funny for the audience. And that one got dead silence. But
is that why you cut it out? Because it didn't test?
Yeah, you know, if something's on the fence, we'll certainly put it in, even if it doesn't play. But when it completely dies and sort of stops the energy of the movie, we will actually heed the advice of the audience in those cases.
Will Ferrell, would you describe your look as the cop who likes to do the paperwork and the forensic accounting?
I hate to sound so simplistic in that I knew that my character would wear glasses, but that was kind of a key element. And once I found kind of the right glasses for this guy, it kind of set the character off. But that he's a guy who's very kind of well put together, but all of his suits are probably bought at the next step below, like a men's warehouse. Not quite a men's warehouse, but
Marshalls?
Maybe a Marshalls, yeah. And so he's very sensible, very prudent with his finances. And yeah, so we tried to embody that character in the look.
We said a little bit it was like Keith Olbermann with a gun, sort of the vibe.
You know, you mentioned the eyeglasses, and they're kind of like the 80s version of aviator glasses.
Yeah, they're not. They're just a little
those
off.
Those wire-rim aviator glasses.
As soon as I found them, we forwarded pictures to Adam, and Adam was like, that's it.
How'd you look for
that's
them?
That's the look. Just with the prop master and just kind of looked through a sea of glasses and...
The prop master brings it in. You don't go to like lens crafters and say, give me something very 80s.
No, I didn't do that. But I did go to I wanted to give myself a standard issue haircut. And I did go to a Supercuts in the San Fernando Valley and just walked in and got a standard haircut. And I then forwarded the pictures to Adam. And you kind of were shocked.
It was a thing where we heard Will was going to do it, and in theory, it sounded like such a great idea. But, you know, you have to remember when you're about to go into a movie, that look is what you carry for the whole movie. So
I think your quote was, we still want you to look good on camera, but the haircut was perfectly bad in a way, and we kind of had to reshape it.
Did the haircutter not know who you were?
She cut my hair for 15 minutes and then – halfway, she didn't say a word, and then finally, towards the end of the haircut, she's like, you're one of the stepbrothers, aren't you? And I said, yes. And then that's all we mentioned. We didn't talk anymore. So it was kind of funny.
Now, the other guys may be a comedy, but the explosions in it have to look real. They have to look as real as a real cop film would. And so what are some of the things you each had to learn in order to pull off the explosions and the stunts, you know, like, you know, there's like a wrecking ball that smashes into a car and then into a building, and there's cars crashing into each other, there's explosions.
We were actually pretty thrifty with this movie because, you know, we had to shoot in New York. It was a pretty big movie, so all told we only crashed, like, destroyed like four cars. Right. And we were doubling a lot of cars, and that's kind of what we learned, is that even though these movies look big and excessive, our second unit guys were very thrifty with it, and when we would shoot our stuff, we really had to plan when we were going to break something because we didn't have doubles on it. It wasn't like a $200 million movie where you just do whatever you want. So that was a little surprising to us. And then the rest of it is just a lot of planning, like a lot of storyboarding. You go over it and over it, and you do safety checks. And I mean, some of the stuff's pretty scary what they do. I mean, we have a car that shoots into a building that explodes at one point and jumps another car, and sort of halfway through, you're like, oh, my God, like if anyone got hurt because of this, it's just a comedy, you know. So I think that's about as far as we would ever go with those kinds of stunts.
So you said, Adam McKay, that you had to double cars because you didn't have a big budget. What does that mean?
It means you crash into one and you wreck the right side of it. And then in another scene, you turn it around so you only see the left side and you wreck that. It's real tricky stuff like that. But yeah, they do it. They reuse it. Or if there's not a whole lot of damage to it, sometimes they'll fix it in their own shop or second unit. And I mean, these guys are super crafty. They know what they're doing. So we got a lot of use out of a lot of things.
But to speak to what you were initially bringing up, Terry, I think it is so funny because the action does look so real. And we never wink at any of that.
Yeah, there's actually a couple scenes that are pretty cool, like the slow motion shootout in the office and in the Geary building. And I mean, that was kind of our goal. Like, if you're going to do – it's the same thing we do at Talladega. If you're going to have race scenes, let's at least make them cool. So we did our best. We did our darndest with them. And I think a few times we get off some pretty cool moments.
So even though it's a comedy, you know
– Why didn't you agree with my statement?
That I agree. I was going to start describing it, but I figured how much of the movie should I be giving away? No,
we're
I love the part. No, I love the part where Mark Wahlberg is kind of. He seems to be on some kind of like roller cart or something because he's kind of shooting and rolling backwards at the same time. He's officially on some paper, but yeah, I won't.
That's all we needed, Terry. Yeah. Just affirmation like that. That's
yes,
it.
Right.
We work hard. We're very vulnerable.
So again, you know, it's a comedy, but the stunt had to look real, and you use the same kind of stuff that the real action movies do. So Adam McKay, that meant you had the real responsibility of making sure no one got hurt, not the kind of thing you'd have to worry about as much in something like Anchorman. But so was that a lot to carry around?
Well, you know, all you can really do as director is sort of set a tone. And the tone I tried to set was I just constantly said safety first, don't do anything that's risky. I constantly checked with, you know, Conrad, our second unit director, and Brad Martin, our stunt coordinator, and is there anything that's edgy? Please don't do it. Don't do it. It's not worth it. And I just kept saying that over and over again. Fortunately, you know, Conrad and Brad are like consummate pros, so they were super safety conscious. And, you know, we had there's always a couple close calls, but, you know, knock on wood, thank God, no one was seriously injured, and you get through it. But it's crazy. It's a part of filmmaking people don't often think about, that people do get hurt doing these insane stunts. And so that's the only thing you can do. There's some, you know, some people shoot a little looser from the hip and say, just get it done. And I just tried not to do that and over again said, be safe. And our producers said the same thing. Will, on the other hand, had a whole different attitude about it.
I would then, behind Adam's back, tell everyone, don't listen to him. We got to get this shot, and you're fired if you don't. So between the two approaches, I think it came out pretty good.
Yeah. I wasn't happy with what he was doing, and it undermined a lot of my credibility as a director. But the movie did work out, and no one was injured. And, what are you going to do? You know, Will wants the movie to be good.
Now, there's also, like, a financial scam reform theme through the movie, because the main villains are involved with financial misdeeds. And, you know, there's references to the Federal Reserve. There's a few, like, Federal Reserve and SEC jokes. like, what's it like to write jokes like that and not worry that people won't get it?
Well, you know, there's nothing that people love more than a Federal Reserve joke.
Now, don't I know?
Yeah. I mean, you can tour the Midwest for years based on prime rate and actuarial jokes. And, yeah. We thought that was kind of a cool thing with the reason you could do a cop buddy movie was because crime has changed so much. You have a guy like Bernie Madoff literally steal $80 billion. You have, you know, AIG steal hundreds of billions, Goldman Sachs. Crime has changed so much, and to really do a movie with like drug dealers or drug smugglers is kind of almost quaint at this point. So we wanted to have that sort of lace throughout it and yet, you know, not be too didactic or boring about it. And it fit in pretty nicely. It doesn't tend to stop the rhythm. And I think people can feel the stakes of it too. They know that it relates to all of us. It actually is high crime. So you know, it's a comedy, but you somewhat care what they're doing.
So do you have another project that you're going to be working on together now that The Other Guys is finished?
We actually want to do the Fresh Air movie.
Oh, of course. Of course you should.
We just need you to sign a release, Terry.
You've been very difficult through all the legal proceedings.
Yeah. I'm happy to play myself. It's an adventure film, right? It's an adventure film where I sit in a chair reading all day. But it's exciting.
It's going to be for IMAX. It's going to be 3D.
Yeah, that's right.
It's a 500-day shoot.
Well, congratulations on the new one. Thanks so much for coming back to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much, Terry. It's a pleasure.
Thanks, Terry. Thanks for having us.
Will Ferrell and Adam McKay speaking to Terry Gross last year. Their comedy film, The Other Guys, is now out on DVD. This is Fresh Air. I'm TV critic David Bean Cooley. It's a busy weekend for television, with three new series premiering Sunday on cable and public TV. Episodes and Shameless on the Showtime cable network and Downton Abbey on PBS. A few things about these shows should be noted at the start. They're all very well acted, cleverly written, fun to watch, and a little unusual. Not one of them comes from commercial broadcast TV, which continues to play things safe and boring this season. And, by coincidence, all of them have something to do with the United Kingdom. Downton Abbey, the latest miniseries import from what used to be known as Masterpiece Theatre, is a great new period drama the way the British used to make them, back in the days of Brideshead Revisited. Shameless, a new comedy starring William H. Macy, isn't a British show, but it's an American remake of one. And Episodes, a new comedy starring Matt LeBlanc, is about a British sitcom that's being adapted for America like The Office was, and with the former star of Friends playing himself, offered the leading role. Let's start with Downton Abbey, the best imported miniseries since Bleak House. It's written by Julian Fellowes, who wrote the movie Gosford Park, and it's a kind of modern take on upstairs-downstairs. It's got the same division between the downstairs people, the servants, and the upstairs people, their wealthy employers. Except in Downton Abbey, which takes place in the early 20th century, money is so scarce, the residents of the abbey may soon lose title to their own estate. And while the servants downstairs iron the morning newspaper so the ink won't run on the hands of the Earl of Grantham, the headlines themselves deliver some unsettling news about other people of privilege aboard the Titanic. Jim Carter plays the head butler, Mr. Carson, and Hugh Bonneville plays the Earl, who turns out to be surprisingly and endearingly sensitive.
Good morning, Carson.
Good morning, my lord.
Is it true what they're saying?
I believe so, my lord.
I'm afraid we'll know some people on it. I don't suppose there are any lists of survivors yet.
I understand most of the ladies were taken off in time.
You mean the ladies in first class? God help the poor devils below decks.
This miniseries pays equal attention down below and up above, with characters that are full of surprises and quirks, and storylines that offer the same. It's not unreasonable to expect a period drama like Downton Abbey to offer scenes of illicit romance and unexpected death. But at the same time, all that, and there's a fox hunt, too. Shameless, based on a British series that has run for 8 seasons now, stars William H. Macy as an irresponsible drunk with a bunch of kids, who cope mostly not because of him, but in spite of him. This American remake, like the original, is written by Paul Abbott. And if you've watched a lot of British imports, you know his work. The detective series Cracker, the original miniseries version of State of Play. Shameless is a comedy, but a really, really dark one. One that almost dares you to like its central character. The series is daring in other ways, too. For one thing, Macy, the star of the show, barely appears in Sunday's premiere episode, which focuses instead on his eldest daughter, played by Emmy Rossum, and the other kids. But they're strong enough to carry on without him, which in this show is the entire point. There's a similar trick pulled in the opening program of Episodes, which stars Matt LeBlanc as an exaggerated version of Matt LeBlanc. He shows up in the opening scene, but only to launch a flashback, which takes up the entire 7 episodes of the show's first limited season. He doesn't even reappear until episode 2. But as with William H. Macy in Shameless, the show works just fine until he shows up. The real focus of Episodes is on Sean and Beverly, writers of a fictional, award-winning British TV comedy. One that an American TV executive persuades them to come to America to remake because it's his favorite show. Only after they sign up and show up do they realize he's never even seen it. And in episode 2 of Episodes, when they take a courtesy lunch meeting with Matt LeBlanc, it's only because they're told he saw and loved their series while making a movie in England. It doesn't take them long to learn that's not quite true either. Stephen Mangan plays Sean, Tamsin Gregg is Sean's wife and writing partner Beverly, and Matt LeBlanc, approaching their restaurant table while talking on his cell phone, is himself. Sort of.
They're asking if we have the financing?
Screw that. Tell them we're looking at another location, and if we're not closed by the end of today, the whole thing is off the table. But, sorry. I'm trying to buy a restaurant.
I'm Beverly. This is Sean.
Hey. So, I'm here, why?
Yeah, well, to talk about our show.
What show?
Brilliant.
Did you recently shoot a movie in England?
No.
So you're not a huge fan?
Of England?
No, of us.
Oh, you? No.
Well, this isn't at all awkward.
Hey, let me ask you something. Would you go to a restaurant where you roll your own sushi?
Absolutely not.
See, that's what I'm afraid of. Oh, one sec.
Episodes is unexpectedly good, sharp, and funny. And knows the territory, because co-creator David Crane was one of the creators of Friends. And he doesn't just focus on Matt LeBlanc, either. Tamsin Gregg, especially, is a real joy. In fact, all three of these shows, Episodes, Shameless, and Downton Abbey, are pleasures to watch. And not one of them, it's worth reiterating, comes from the standard Hollywood system. The breakdown of a marriage is the subject of the new drama Blue Valentine. It stars Ryan Gosling and Michelle Williams as a young couple at the end of their marriage. Through flashbacks, the movie also shows them in earlier, more romantic times. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Gone are the days when filmmakers kept a respectful distance from their characters. In Blue Valentine, writer and director Derek Cianfrance is obsessive in how he uses the handheld camera to get in his actors' faces. Yet there's something in those faces to see, something momentous, angry, desperate, unmanageable. The film is a rough ride, with the shock absorbers removed. Ryan Gosling and Michelle Williams play a married couple, Dean and Cindy, with a little daughter named Frankie. Dean paints houses, and Cindy is a nurse. The movie's opening is as ominous as any horror film. The family dog is missing. Cindy is strangely cold toward Dean and fed up. Something bad is clearly coming. Blue Valentine has a time warp gimmick. Cianfrance cuts back and forth between what might be the end of this marriage and its bumpy but charming beginning. Now, beginnings and endings are relatively simple, the diagram. The true drama is in the unresolved middle zone, when a couple's attraction and repulsion seesaws. Here, there's no seesaw, just the sea and then the saw. But when we look at the beginning of Cindy and Dean's relationship from the vantage of hindsight, we see things we wouldn't otherwise. The very things that are right about them back then are years later wrong. It turns out Dean saved Cindy in a sense. She was stuck in an awful relationship with a local jock and dominated by an abusive father. And Dean was funny and smitten and, more important, eager to take care of her. In one of the film's high points, they duck into the doorway of a closed store, and Dean induces Cindy, with much prodding, to tap dance while he plays guitar and warbles like Tiny Tim. Her surrender is infectious and enchanting. It's only from the perspective of the future that we detect a compulsive, even scary quality in Dean's jokiness. Cianfrance cuts to years later, when Dean hopes to rekindle the marriage, and books the couple into a gimmicky theme motel, where they're ensconced in the blue-lit, quote, future room that seems suitable only for android mating. Too much cheap vodka adds to the non-fun. Finally, Cindy comes out with what's been eating her up, that Dean is going nowhere.
Listen, I didn't want to be somebody's husband, okay? And I didn't want to be somebody's dad. That wasn't my goal in life. Some guys it is. It wasn't mine. But somehow, it was what I wanted. I didn't know that. And that's all I want to do. I don't want to do anything else. That's what I want to do. I work so I can do that.
I'd like to see you have a job where you don't have to start drinking at 8 o'clock in the morning to go to it.
No, I have a job that I can drink at 8 o'clock in the morning. What a luxury, you know? I get up from work, I have a beer, I go to work, I paint somebody's house, they're excited about it, I come home, I get to be with you. This is the dream.
That's not too promising. And Gosling's Dean becomes increasingly unhinged. He jabbers at her instead of engaging. As she withdraws, he seems on the verge of snapping. Gradually, Dean loses stature, while Cindy, a killjoy in the early scenes, becomes the movie's true protagonist. I frankly found it hard to watch Michelle Williams without thinking about her breakup with Heath Ledger, the father of her child, and the impact of his subsequent death. That's not a problem, though. If anything, it makes her seem more vulnerable. She's always been a raw, see-through actress, and under the camera's tight scrutiny, her emotions seem more seismic than ever, even when her face is still. We sense the strain that comes with Cindy's self-protection. She holds it in and holds it in until she can't anymore. Some critics have found Blue Valentine monotonous, the same note hit again and again. I don't entirely disagree, although I think that its oppressive monotony evokes the dissolution of a marriage shockingly well. There's another major figure on whom to focus, the little girl Frankie. Faith Wilotka is an unusually convincing child actress, and her playful rapport with Gosling's Dean makes you like him despite his demons. The child is the movie's truest casualty, and the one whose future relationships will doubtless be colored by what happens to her parents' marriage. In Blue Valentine, the bad vibes just keep rippling.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hirschfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.